KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A dust storm in Kansas caused a 71-car pileup. Tornadoes ripped through Missouri and Mississippi. More than 30 people are dead across the South and Midwest. We take stock of the recovery on Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, when Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil was arrested by immigration agents, his wife filmed everything. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Martinez. We asked Noor Abdallah about that arrest and her struggle to get across back. Also, what's at stake if the Trump administration shuts down the Voice of America? And how would Irish musicians celebrate St. Patrick's Day all month long? It's Monday, March 17th. New York's Irish history runs deep. It held its first St. Patrick's Day parade today, all the way back in 1762. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Trump administration has deported some 250 people it claims are gang members from Venezuela. But the people were not returned to Venezuela. They were flown to El Salvador. Salvadoran officials have imprisoned them. No evidence has been presented to support the accusations of crime against the deportees. A federal judge in the U.S. verbally told the federal government to turn the deporting flights back, but that didn't happen. President Trump invoked a rarely used wartime power to justify his actions. But the U.S. is not at war with Venezuela. Sky Perryman is the CEO of the legal organization Democracy Forward. She says her group has filed suit along with the ACLU to block Trump's use of the wartime power.
This is an expansion of presidential power that could essentially say, I mean, these people have now been, you know, removed, or the president is seeking to remove them without any type of due process. And that's against our Constitution, but it's also a threat to everyone.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. President Trump ordered airstrikes on the Houthi-led regions in Yemen over the weekend. He is vowing to use overwhelming lethal force as long as the Houthis keep attacking shipping vessels. NPR's Luke Garrett reports now a Trump cabinet member is saying that targets in Iran could be next.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says these strikes are not retaliatory or reactionary, as they were during the Biden administration. Rubio tells CBS News,
"This is an effort to take away their ability to control global shipping in that part of the world. That's just not going to happen anymore."
And Trump's national security advisor, Mike Waltz, criticized Iran's support for the Houthis. He also took one step further, telling ABC News that Iranian positions in Yemen could be airstrike targets.
"Other things that they have put in to help the Houthis attack the global economy, those targets will be on the table too."
Around 50 people have been killed during these airstrikes, and the Houthi rebels vowed to, quote, meet escalation with escalation, according to the Associated Press. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a modest rebound in retail sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 100 points in early trading.
Retail spending rose by 0.2% in February after a sharp drop the month before. The spending picture was mixed, however. Shoppers spent more money on groceries but less on restaurant meals. Spending at department stores was down last month, but spending at online stores was way up. Tomorrow, the Commerce Department will offer a snapshot of the home building business. President Trump's tariffs on lumber and other building materials are expected to raise the cost of building a single-family home by $7,500 or more. Mortgage rates are another big factor in housing affordability. Rates have come down a little bit in recent weeks. Freddie Mac says the average 30-year home loan now costs just over 6.6%.
NPR's Scott Horsley. This is NPR. Deadly storms across the central and southeastern U.S. killed at least 39 people over the weekend. Sudden dust storms in Texas and Kansas turned deadly. A 71-car pileup in Kansas killed at least 8 people when visibility plunged to near zero. Tornadoes killed more people in Missouri and Mississippi. March Madness is here. The women's college basketball tournament tips off this week. South Carolina and its head coach, Dawn Staley, are looking to defend last year's title. But NPR's Becky Sullivan reports they have tough competition this year.
The Gamecocks went undefeated last season from start to finish, winning the championship. This year, they earned a one seed, but look a bit more vulnerable. The top overall seed went to UCLA, a school whose men's team is full of history, but the women have never reached the Final Four. With stars Lauren Betts and Kiki Rice, anything less than that will be a disappointment this time. Southern Cal and Texas are the other top seeds. The presumptive number one pick in the upcoming WNBA draft is Paige Beckers. Her UConn Huskies haven't won a championship since 2016. They're a two seed now. The women's tournament tips off Wednesday with a pair of play-in games, and the round of 64 begins Friday. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Closing arguments are set for today in a civil lawsuit in North Dakota. The suit is against climate action group Greenpeace. The parent company of the Dakota Access Pipeline is suing Greenpeace and others. The company claims their protests delayed the start of the pipeline and increased company costs. Greenpeace claims the lawsuit was filed to try to bankrupt the group and silence free speech. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, I speak with the wife of Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil, a target of the Trump administration's deportation push. But first,
at least three dozen people are dead after severe weather sparked tornadoes, dust storms, wildfires, and heavy rainfall across the South and Midwest over the weekend.
The storms continue to rattle the East Coast overnight, but have largely moved offshore. Residents across the country are still taking stock of the damage.
NPR's Rylan Barton has been following this, so tell us what happened over the weekend.
Yeah, so this really volatile storm system affected a huge swath of the country. It created a trail of destruction from Kansas and Oklahoma down to Texas, and then over east to Missouri, Arkansas, and Mississippi. In the east side, on Friday and Saturday, the system dropped baseball-sized hail in some places, produced dozens of deadly tornadoes. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves said that six people were killed in tornadoes there. Speaking on Sunday, he promised a quick response.
Mississippians, in times like these, step up and do what is necessary to take care of our friends and our neighbors, and that makes me proud to be a Mississippian.
Also, 12 people died in Missouri, where Governor Mike Cahoe said yesterday that hundreds of homes, schools, and businesses were destroyed or severely damaged. In Arkansas, the National Weather Service says that damage from two of the tornadoes there showed they were likely F4s. So that's the second strongest class of tornadoes, with one of them estimated to have a peak wind of 170 miles an hour. The last time that happened on the same day in the state was 1997. First responders across the region are still working to clear debris, restore power to homes, and eventually distribute supplies for recovery.
Yeah, now tell us about the high wind and wildfires that took place on the western side of the area affected by the storm.
Right. So Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas, there were hurricane force winds. They created dust storms and wildfires. On Friday, 8 people died in a 71 vehicle pileup in Kansas. That was after a dust storm suddenly reduced visibility to near zero. That closed Interstate 70 for over 24 hours. Another 3 people were killed in a dust storm related crashes in Amarillo in the Texas Panhandle. In Oklahoma, Governor Kevin Stitt said that high winds stoked more than 130 fires across the state, killing 4 and damaging or destroying nearly 400 homes. And in Texas on Sunday, officials say there's more than 42,000 acres were burning from 36 different wildfires, including a nearly 10,000-acre wildfire near Fredericksburg in central Texas. The threat of fires is expected to continue there into the next week.
Wow, so that's all of that's a lot. What does recovery look like?
So the process is really just starting. President Trump said on his Truth Social account yesterday that he's monitoring the storm damage and that he and First Lady Melania Trump are praying for everyone impacted. He promised to assist state and local officials in the recovery, and he said National Guard troops were already deployed to Arkansas, where the most powerful tornadoes took place. Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders surveyed damage there Saturday.
Our goal is to help and aid the local folks on the ground. Take care of people. We'll worry about the paperwork later.
This is just the beginning of tornado season, and more severe weather could be on its way in the next several weeks.
That's NPR's Ryland Barton. Ryland, thanks.
Thank you.
This was supposed to be a season of joy for 28-year-old Noor Abdullah. She and her husband were preparing for their first child next month. Then he was detained. Those preparations are on hold now as she fights for Mahmoud Khalil's release. The Palestinian Columbia graduate student and legal permanent resident who was taken by Homeland Security agents for his involvement in campus protests against Israel's war in Gaza. In between nonstop calls with lawyers and anxious friends and family, Noor took some time to talk to me about the struggle to get him back. I want to just start with how you're doing, what your days have been like since Mahmoud was taken.
It's been very overwhelming. It's like when I wake up in the morning, it's a lot of like, just go, 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 call after call after call. It really, I don't think it like hits me until like, sorry, I'm a mess this morning.
As an international student, Mahmoud took the risk of arrest, suspension, maybe even losing his student visa at the time, to be a public face of these protests on his college campus. For him, the cause was deeply personal.
Mahmoud is Palestinian. He was a Palestinian refugee in Syria. And then when things started happening in Syria, he was a refugee in Lebanon. So he has been the oppressed person, you know. He believes that, like, he doesn't only have a duty to liberate himself from the oppressor, but also to liberate the oppressors from their hatred and tyranny. And I think that's something he firmly believes in because of his personal experiences, but also because, like, he knows right from wrong.
Neither Noor nor Mahmoud really worried about his choice to protest. They believed they had a right to freely express themselves under the First Amendment. That was an assumption that fell apart the night of Saturday, March 8th, when a man in plain clothes followed them into their building.
He's like, "Are you Mahmoud Khalil?" Mahmoud said, "Yes." And he says, "I'm with the police. You have to come with us." I think at that point, like, honestly, like, my heart sank. I want to say, like, Mahmoud tried to prepare me because I feel like he had a feeling, but I don't know that I ever took him seriously.
In what way was he trying to prepare you?
Like, 2 days before, he told me, like, "Do you know your rights if ICE comes to your door?" And I, like, brushed it off. I was like, "What are you saying? Like, don't say that. That's not going to happen, you know?" But he was like, "No, like, you need to know." And he had emailed Columbia a day before, basically saying, like, "I have a feeling that ICE is going to come. I need you guys to intervene."
And he didn't get a response to that email, right?
He didn't get a response to that email, no.
And so at this point, your heart is sinking. What is happening in front of you?
Mahmoud is trying to ask the officer, like, "Who are you with?" He said, "Department of Homeland Security." And then he asked him, like, "Can I see a warrant?" He's like, "It's on my phone," but never really showed it to us. And the officer was like, "Give the keys to your wife," basically. And I was like, "I'm not leaving him." And the officer goes, "I'll arrest you too."
He said this even though Noor is a U.S. citizen.
Mahmoud gives me the keys and he says, "Go get my green card."
When Noor returned, 3 more immigration agents had surrounded him. One said Mahmoud's student visa was revoked, so Noor showed him her husband's green card.
And the agent looked very, very confused, and whoever was on the phone with him said, like, bring him in anyways.
You're going to be under arrest, so turn around.
This is audio from footage Noor filmed that night as agents placed Mahmoud in handcuffs.
Turn around.
Okay, he's not resisting. He's giving me his phone, okay?
He appears calm and polite. He looks to his wife to reassure her. She grabs his phone before he's taken away to talk to his immigration lawyer on the line.
Yeah, they just like handcuffed him and took him. I don't know what to do. What should I do? I don't know.
Noor follows the agents outside as they lead Mahmoud into an unmarked car, and she asks their names.
We don't give our names.
And he's saying they don't give their names.
They'll be taken to immigration custody at 26 Federal Plaza.
And then they just drove away with him.
Were you terrified?
Very. I think that's probably the most terrifying thing that's ever happened to me.
For 38 hours, she didn't know where her husband was. And then he called.
So I answered, and he's like, hi, how are you? How's the baby? Aww. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, don't act so normal, please. But, you know, that's the type of person that he is. Even through all of that, like, he was trying to calm me down, you know?
Mahmoud is at a detention facility in Louisiana, and his case is being fought in court. It's captured the nation's attention. There are demonstrations and debates on whether free speech is in fact protected in this country, and if Khalil is paying the price for protesting.
No! We want justice, you say now! Release Mahmoud Khalil, now!
Where exactly are we in the poem that begins, when they came for the communists, I did not speak out? Well, they've already come for the asylum speakers. They've come for the migrant families. Now they've come for Mahmoud Khalil. It's not a very long poem. So how far down the list do you think you are?
The Trump administration says that Mahmoud Khalil is a Hamas supporter, a designated terrorist organization in the U.S., while presenting no evidence of that accusation. Plus, the administration is not saying he's being deported for a crime, nor is he being charged with one. They're instead invoking a rarely used immigration provision that gives the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio in this case, the power to deport someone he deems could have, quote, serious adverse foreign policy consequences. President Trump has promised more student protesters will be detained and deported. I put these accusations to Noor.
I just want to be clear that the smears against Mahmoud are exactly that. They're smears. He has and always will stand up for what's right. And the way that he was taken from his family was not right.
How are you doing this? Are you preparing for the baby? Like, what do you think Mahmoud will be home?
Even before all of this happened, I would joke with him. I'm like, what if you're like traveling or something? Or what if I was visiting my family and then like you weren't able to like come for the birth? You know, that was so scary to me, for me to have to give birth by myself. And now we just don't really know if he is going to be there.
Let's say tomorrow this is resolved and Mahmoud is released and this case is dropped. Do you think you two would feel safe just going back to living here, the lives that you were living?
I don't know that I love this apartment. And I love the place that we live. And Mahmoud, like, we always talk about, like, I wish we could stay here forever, right? But I think, unfortunately, they kind of, they took away that sense of security and that sense of safety. And I don't know that that's something really you can fix after what happened.
Are you talking about the apartment or are you talking about the country?
I think both.
So you don't know if you would stay in the U.S.?
I can't. Honestly, like, that's a hard question to answer.
Critics say maybe that's the point, that the fear of what's happening will be enough to silence speech the government doesn't agree with. That was Noor Abdallah, the wife of Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia graduate student and lawful permanent resident the Trump administration is trying to deport. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Clay Risen describes a political movement which destroyed the careers of thousands of teachers, civil servants, and artists whose beliefs or associations were deemed un-American. His book, Red Scare, is about post-World War II America, but he says there's a through line connecting that era to our current political moment. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal judge in Boston has scheduled a hearing this morning about what he calls serious allegations that Customs and Border Protection officials disobeyed his court order.
A doctor who was legally working in the U.S. has been sent back to Lebanon. And in a separate case, a German-born green card holder is being detained. And that's raising concerns about an immigration crackdown in Boston.
NPR's Tovia Smith has been following the story. So first bring us up to date on the case of the doctor who was returned to Lebanon, whose case is being heard in court this morning.
Yeah, this is about Rasha Alloway, a kidney transplant doctor at a Brown University-affiliated medical group. She was here on an H-1B visa. That's the one meant for highly specialized workers. And she went to visit family in Lebanon, and when she returned, she was detained for 36 hours at Boston's Logan Airport and had her phone taken from her, according to her cousin. Her cousin was the one who got the federal court order barring officials from sending her back. And apparently her lawyers even made a frantic call to the airport control tower trying to stop the plane she was on. But they say officials, quote, willfully disobeyed the judge's order and sent her back anyway. We expect to learn more shortly from government lawyers in federal court this morning. But so far, we've got just a preview from a spokesperson who said that officials use rigorous screening to help keep threats out of the country, is how they put it.
Okay, so now the separate case of the German-born green card holder. That's a different situation?
Yeah, in this case, Fabian Schmidt was detained for days when he tried to return to Logan Airport from a trip to Europe, according to his family. And officials suggest it's because he faced misdemeanor drug and DUI charges about a decade ago, and he was a no-show for a court hearing on his case. His family says that's because he never got the notice. But in this case, also, relatives say that Schmidt was mistreated in custody, violently interrogated, was how his mother put it when she spoke to GBH reporter Sarah Betancourt.
He had to go and be stripped naked and was showered by two officers with ice cold water and was interrogated again.
Officials say the claims are, quote, blatantly false, without, however, saying specifically which claims. And they add, quote, when an individual is found with drug-related charges and tries to reenter the country, officers will take proper action, they said.
Yeah. And Sylvia, all this comes as the Trump administration has been promising to take a hard line on immigration in general. What kind of reaction are you seeing to all this in Boston?
Yeah, this is being seen as Trump making good on one of his central campaign promises or threats, however you see it. And this was reiterated, by the way, by Border Czar Tom Homan just a few weeks ago when he specifically called out Boston for vowing to not help ICE enforcement officers.
I'm coming to Boston. I'm bringing hell with me.
Meantime, those who oppose the Trump administration's hardline stance are also fired up. There's a protest planned for this evening to support the doctor who was sent back to Lebanon, as, of course, there have been other protests, including many around the nation this weekend in support of the Columbia student Mahmoud Khalil. He was taken into custody by officials who say his campus protest activities basically amount to a national security threat because they, quote, align with Hamas, which is a U.S.-designated terrorist group.
All right, that's NPR's Tovia Smith. Tovia, thanks.
Thank you.
Hollywood Forever Cemetery is running out of room, so it's expanding, not out, but up. Next month, they're formally opening a high-rise mausoleum. It'll provide space for thousands more interments. Steve Futterman took a visit.
Welcome to Hollywood Forever. My name is Carrie. I'm the official in-house tour guide here.
This graveyard sits in the middle of Hollywood, bordered by Paramount Studios and Santa Monica Boulevard. It looks much like a park, with green lawns, a few small lakes, and peacocks roaming among the monuments, memorials, and gravesites. It's the final resting home for many legendary Hollywood figures. Carrie Bible has been conducting weekend tours here for 20 years.
This is the grave of Hollywood legend Cecil B. DeMille, one of the great directors in Hollywood's golden age.
Judy Garland's final resting spot is also here, along with silent screen legend Rudolph Valentino, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden, and rock star Johnny Ramone. His gravesite has a statue of Ramone playing his guitar. But several years ago, it became clear that Hollywood Forever was facing a very serious problem. It was running out of room.
Just like any other city, this city of the dead has to build up to maximize space.
That's co-owner Tyler Cassidy. His solution to the space problem is a five-story mausoleum.
This was necessary, right?
This was necessary. We're in the middle of a giant metropolis.
And Cassidy says without the money from the new burials, they wouldn't be able to maintain the rest of the historic cemetery. The vertical mausoleum is made of concrete, quartzite, and marble with a brutalist design. And the architects built it to take advantage of its iconic location.
It's profoundly of Hollywood and Los Angeles.
Michael Lair is one of the designers.
You've got 360 views, Hollywood sign, downtown. Today I was up there, you can see the ocean.
Ricardo Pentreath has already purchased his spot in the high rise. His mother is buried in this cemetery. He wanted to be close to her. We visited his future resting place on the first floor.
Let's hope there is in about 40, 50 years from now. I understand that this marble is from Brazil, and I love Brazil. It's very appealing, and well, it's gonna be easier to, when it's my time, to put me in.
The problem Hollywood Forever has been facing with space isn't unique.
In particular major cities where some of the historic cemeteries, they're essentially running out of room and there's no chance to expand outward.
Carlton Basmajian is a professor of urban planning at Iowa State University. He says that even though many people are now choosing less traditional alternatives like non-burial cremation,
there's enough deaths and enough demand for these spaces that I think we're starting to see this across the country at some level.
Tyler Cassidy, the co-owner of Hollywood Forever, says he's been contacted by operators of other cemeteries who are looking at this high-rise as a possible solution they can use as well. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Hollywood.
This is NPR News.
Wouldn't it be nice if AI could actually do things for us?
Even just to do very basic things, like being able to make a sandwich or being able to clean a kitchen.
Some researchers are now putting AI into robots. Don't worry, they're not going to take over the world. Yet.
We can just throw some water on them, and in most cases they don't work anyway, so.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More on how researchers are applying AI to robotics on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Authorities in seven states are reporting storm-related deaths from a weekend weather system that pushed through the Midwest and South. At least 39 people were killed by severe weather, including tornadoes and wildfires fanned by strong winds. 12 of those killed were in Missouri. Fatalities were also reported in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Alabama. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO reports on tornado damage in Louisiana.
In Kentwood, Louisiana, a tornado destroyed nearly 30 people's homes. Sheriff Gerald Sticker says farmers have been using their tractors to haul away downed trees.
They were working right alongside of first responders, helping to clear roadways once we were sure power lines were dead. You know, they're very resourceful, resilient. Couldn't be more proud of them.
Emergency management officials are now focused on getting power back to tens of thousands of people. Governors in at least four states have declared states of emergency to help fast-track the setup of shelters and rebuilding efforts. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
Retail sales in the U.S. rose 0.2% in February. The number from the Commerce Department is sharply lower than what economists were expecting and adds to concerns about consumer confidence. This is NPR News. President Trump is gutting a federal agency that oversees homelessness policy as part of his efforts to downsize government. As NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, a White House memo says the agency is no longer needed despite homelessness in the U.S. hitting a record high last year.
The move targets the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, which coordinates policy among 19 agencies. It was created in 1987 precisely to make government more efficient, says Jeff Olivet, who led it most recently. The memo calls for reducing the agency to the minimum required by law, but with just 20 people, he says it's already bare bones.
It's doing a lot with very little. And any cuts will make it impossible for the agency to fulfill its statutory mandates.
Olivet credits the agency with helping dramatically reduce veteran homelessness and helping certain cities stem the rise in people sleeping outside. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
NASA says astronauts Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore are scheduled to undock from the International Space Station early tomorrow and splash down off the coast of Florida before the end of the day. They've been aboard the ISS for more than 9 months. Weather permitting, they'll be making the return trip with two other astronauts. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 175 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. After more than 80 years, the voice of America is mostly silent. More than 1,000 employees were put on an indefinite mass suspension over the weekend after the Trump administration ordered its parent company, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, to stop all activities not required by law. The Voice of America, or VOA, has been broadcasting American news and culture globally since World War II, as we can hear in his 1950 recording from the National Archive.
Objectivity is the keynote of voice news programming, just as truth is the overall keynote of all Voice of America programs.
Until now, Voice of America reached 350 million people around the world with programming in nearly 50 languages. Jody Ginsberg is here to discuss this. She's the chief executive of the Committee to Protect Journalists, an independent nonprofit organization that promotes press freedom worldwide. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning.
So, Jody, your organization is asking Congress to intervene here. Why?
This is a congressionally funded federal agency, USAGM, which funds and supports not just Voice of America, but also Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, and a number of other outlets broadcasting information to and about countries that traditionally have had high levels of censorship, countries like Russia, countries like Belarus, Cuba. And the work that they do is absolutely vital. And so it's critical that this, the VOA, but also all of the other agencies and their funding be restored as soon as possible.
Why is it vital, in your view?
Because the work that Voice of America, and I know it's not necessarily very familiar to very many Americans because it doesn't broadcast to America, it broadcasts to and about countries that have traditionally had high levels of censorship, and it's really vital. This morning, a colleague of mine who works in Cambodia emailed me to tell me how distraught they are that an information source that they rely on for credible information because they cannot get it from news sources within Cambodia would be removed, and that's repeated in country after country. America is very proud of the First Amendment, the ability to report freely here and have very many news outlets that can report independently without government interference, but that is not true in vast swathes of the globe.
Now, the White House released a statement over the weekend that accused the broadcaster of, quote, radical propaganda and left-wing bias. That's something we've heard repeatedly from Trump and his allies about traditional media outlets as well. What's your reaction to that statement?
Well, I think that demonstrates that this is not a cost-saving measure. It's politically motivated. And if you look at the list of supposed charges against Voice of America, it includes such allegations as having written about transgender migrants. I think that is a very hard argument to make, and I would like to see the administration make that to the five, for example, Radio Free Europe journalists who are currently in jail, two in Belarus, one in Russia-occupied Crimea, one in Azerbaijan, one in Russia. The work that the VOA, RFE does, and the number of other agents, number of other news outlets run by USAGM is to report freely and independently and without government interference, and that's crucial, on news from around the world.
Now, there will be Americans who don't want U.S. tax dollars going to funding VOA when they feel the government overspends and needs to address things at home, or maybe because they agree that VOA has a left-wing bias. What would you say to them?
I would say that this isn't just a matter of cost, although the cost is very limited. It's also a matter of, frankly, national security. And we've had Representative Meeks from the House Foreign Affairs Committee and Representative Frankel both issued statements talking about the threats from this cancellation to national security around the world. We've called it a gift to autocrats. If independent organizations like Voice of America, like Radio Free Europe, are not able to report, that simply creates a vacuum into which lies and propaganda from authoritarian regimes can flourish.
Now, we did see some celebration of this decision in places like China. An English language daily funded by the Communist China Party called it excellent news, and calling Radio Free Asia one of the U.S.'s most insidious anti-China propaganda outlets. What do you make of that excitement around the decision in the few seconds we have left?
I think it should be extraordinarily disturbing to everyone here in the United States that countries like China, repressive countries like Russia, are celebrating the cancellation of Voice of America.
Jody Ginsberg, Chief Executive of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
How does one of the most influential Irish musicians in America celebrate today's Irish American holiday? NPR's Dena Ulaby brings us this St. Patrick's Day postcard from the founder of the band Cherish the Ladies.
for Joni Madden. It's not St. Patrick's Day so much as St. Patrick's Month.
We're celebrating with 20 gigs this month. We have 11-piece band on the road, including 6 musicians and 4 step dancers.
They all call it, she says, March Madness.
March Madness. I know that's usually a basketball term, but it's our March Madness.
Madden founded her band, Cherish the Ladies, 40 years ago. At the time, professional Irish music was dominated by men. Now, Cherish the Ladies is a Grammy-nominated Celtic supergroup.
And we've performed almost 4,000 concerts all over the world and recorded 18 albums.
In 2021, Madden was named a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts. When she was growing up, playing Irish music in the Bronx, her flute teacher told her the tin whistle was a toy. But Joni Madden now plays it with the kind of superlative genius that Simone Biles applies to gymnastics.
I just love the feeling I can evoke through that little piece of tin with 6 holes in it. I can really feel my soul coming alive when I'm playing it, and it does something to me.
Madden also composes music. One of her pieces is played now by her band at every concert. It's called Longing for Home.
And I wrote about my parents, who are immigrants that came from Ireland, came here penniless and worked like dogs.
It's an homage, she says, to her ancestors and to every American immigrant.
I play this tune for all the immigrants that came to this country. And for me, I've never met an immigrant that I haven't seen that hasn't worked their behinds off from whatever country they came from. I think immigrant has become a bad word these days. And without the immigrants, this country would be nothing. So everybody from every part of the world helps to make us who we are.
St. Patrick's Day, she says, is an immigrant's holiday. Not just for 30 million Irish Americans, but for Americans, period. And, she adds, this Irish American will be sitting down at the end of March Madness with her band at an Irish pub.
There's some that'll be drinking wine, there'll be some drinking a brandy, there'll be some having a couple of Guinnesses and a couple of Coors Light. We all deserve it because, you know, it's a tough month.
But every month, she says, is a grand one to play Irish music. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Duck populations had been thriving, but a new report shows a 30% decline in duck numbers since 2017. We'll find out why next time on Here and Now.
You're about to step out the door. You've got your keys, your wallet, and NPR. If you have your smartphone, we are with you. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, May Martinez. Dan McKinnon is the general manager of the Utica Comets. That's a minor league hockey team. Now, last week, he traded away defenseman Will McKinnon, his son, to the Cleveland Monsters. Not for another player or even a player to be named later, but for basically nothing, what's called future consideration. That could be anything, like a bag of pucks. Utica is in last place, and Cleveland has a shot at making the playoffs, so it's not like this trade will put their relationship on ice. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. March Madness is here. The brackets for the men's and women's Division I college basketball tournaments were set yesterday, and NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan tirelessly is going over the brackets, and she's here to give us a closer look. Now, the headline for the men's bracket is that 14 of 68 teams are all from one conference. That's a record.
It is a record, in fact. Yeah, I think college sports fans are used to the SEC dominating in football. Now the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, is on top of basketball, too. They were hailed all season long as the strongest conference, and now they are sending, as you say, 14 teams. That's a record. It's all but two teams in the entire conference are going to the big dance, including two of the tournament's number one seeds, top overall seed Auburn, and then Florida, who came on hot to finish the season, I think will be a very popular pick for national champion. And so just a tour de force there.
Yeah, and Duke is another number one seed. Duke is Duke. Mm-hmm. I remember someone saying that. Now, a lot of other perennial contenders and recent champions, though, didn't do so well this year.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of familiar names that are kind of middling seeds this year, including Kansas, UConn, North Carolina. All of them reached the championship game in the last few years, but all of them seeded seven or lower, and then a couple other recent champs in Virginia and Villanova who missed the tournament entirely. Kind of a topsy-turvy year, I would say, in college basketball as college sports undergo these changes we've been talking about a lot, with players getting paid, transferring freely, that kind of thing. And so you have these longtime college basketball coaches who have retired. Their schools have struggled to sort of transition. And so as a result, it really feels like the upside of that being a year where there could be a first-time champion or teams reaching the Final Four for the first time in school history, which I think is very cool.
All right, now the women's bracket, which I'm looking at both brackets. This one, to me, is the juicier one in terms of possible mm-hmm. Final Four matchups. The top overall team is UCLA.
Yeah, and I think UCLA, now that's a name that used to be synonymous with men's college basketball, but actually the women's team has never reached the Final Four. So this is the best season in school history. Very exciting there. Lots of contenders, though, including, of course, South Carolina, led by head coach Dawn Staley, who is an icon in this sport. Last year, they went undefeated, including the national title. But this year, not quite so invincible. The other top two seeds are Southern California and Texas. And as you say, I just think, you know, women's basketball right now has so many electric stars that sort of drive interest in the game. You have Juju Watkins with the Trojans. You have Flaje Johnson at LSU. Paige Beckers with UConn. UCLA have this pair of stars in Lauren Betts and Kiki Rice. All of them are a treat to watch no matter who they're playing. It's going to be really exciting to see some of those Goliath versus Goliath matchups once we get a little further into the tournament.
Yeah, UCLA has only lost twice this season, both times to USC, their mm-hmm. crosstown rival. I hope they meet up somehow in the mm-hmm. Final Four. Okay, so for people that might be trying to fill out their brackets today, give us some help, Becky. Who do you see as a Cinderella?
Well, in the men's tournament, I think important to point out for people filling out their brackets that an 11 seed has won a first round game over a 6 seed in all of the past 20 tournaments. So I think you should pick at least one. I think this year the trendiest pick will certainly be Drake over Missouri. Drake, first time D1 head coach in Ben McCollum, who came from Northwest Missouri State, where he led that team to 4 Division II national titles. They have great defense. I'm also intrigued by UC San Diego, who recently moved up to D1, and they come into the dance on a 15 game winning streak.
All right, what about the women's?
Well, in the women's, I think there aren't really Cinderellas in the same way there are in the men's, but if you want to go for one, I think 6-seed Iowa could be frisky, who pulled off a win over USC earlier this season. So even though they no longer have that superstar Caitlin Clark who's in the WNBA, they still have a lot of tournament experience.
All right, that's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Importers play the tariff dodgeball.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the Financial Times, whose pink pages encourage fearless thinking on American news. There's more at ft.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. It is an edgy time for importers and exporters, unclear on two key pieces of information. Is there a border tariff and how much? For decades, businesses have leaned into just-in-time logistics, make the product in the most efficient place possible, and only ship it when needed. But given tit-for-tat tariffs, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looks at just-in-case logistics.
Just-in-case logistics is about having a backup plan, says international trade lawyer Skyler Rocky Rydell, founder of Rydell Law Firm.
Old fashioned. We buy what we need, we store it, and we use it when we need to. And we don't rely on a supply chain to get it to us immediately when we need it.
That means stockpiling extra products or parts so you're covered in the event of, oh, I don't know, a trade war. Another component of just-in-case logistics.
We've seen a big increase in a product that's called trade credit insurance, and that's essentially protection for customers in the event that a customer defaults.
David Kinzel is a senior vice president focusing on the political risk practice at the global insurance and risk advisory firm Marsh. He says his team used to barely spend any time on these types of insurance products. Now, with the trade war, it takes up about two-thirds of his day.
We've already seen, I'd say, an increase in business of at least 20% so far this year.
And he expects that to grow because the global trade environment is getting less and less predictable. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
I see news that retail sales in February went up slightly from a low January, but there wasn't the sharper rebound experts were forecasting. The Fed meets on jobs, interest rates, and recession versus growth starting tomorrow. Also this morning, the Club of Industrialized Countries, the OECD, cut its global growth forecast from 3.3 to 3.1% this year due to trade friction. Now the S&P is up 0.4%. The Nasdaq is down 0.1%. The Dow's up 0.5%, 197 points. Starting tomorrow here, we'll bring you teachable moments from the biggest of rodeos. They're real markets at work, and I've been getting a string of tricks of the trade tips from the pros at work there. Part of Rodeo Houston is quite a carnival where Dominic Palmieri has to arrange the supply chain for not-so-low-cal food, systems that geared up 6 months ago. Here's a taste of what this Midway gourmet helps us understand about the U.S. labor market, given who he's hiring for the rodeo.
People are, they're looking for work. The biggest section that we have right now is, believe it or not, people that are employed full-time that are coming to us saying, I need an extra 15 to 20 hours a week. I'll work Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. Can I come in at 6 and work to close? So these are full-time employees working a job somewhere else that are looking to make a little extra money.
Palmieri is responsible for the carnival, serving things like a plump glazed donut on top of brief biscuit, just saying, not endorsing. Our series will also include career coaching from a rodeo clown and how a Houston hip-hop legend built a burger business there. All this week and soon after on YouTube and beyond.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com. And by Certified Financial Planner Professionals. Learn more about CFP professionals at letsmakeaplan.org.
Now let's take the Marketplace Economic Pulse checkups from a range of perspectives. There's research from the consulting firm BCG that finds just 12% of all U.S. workers get child care benefits through their employer. Companies that offer it may have a leg up over the competition. Policy correspondent Rachel Cohen has been writing about this for Vox. She spoke to my colleague Sabri Benishore.
So there's obviously a big benefit to employees when their employers offer child care, but what do the employers actually gain?
You know, for a long time, employer childcare, it was really seen as this sort of nice-to-have perk. Most companies didn't provide it. I mean, most companies still don't provide it. But that's really started to change as employers started to realize this is actually a really important thing we need to get people to be able to show up at work and pay attention at work and recruit people to come to our cities and work at our companies. And that really sort of crystallized during the pandemic when all these people had to make really hard choices between, do I stay home with my kid as their school is closed, or do I go to my job?
Yeah, there's a lot of experimentation right now, as you write, with different states trying different things to figure out how to make employer-sponsored healthcare happen more? What are they trying, and is it working?
Yeah, a really popular one that's emerged over the last couple of years is called TriShare in Michigan, and it's drawn a lot of attention because it just sounds simple. It targets these workers in the middle class who otherwise aren't eligible for subsidies. The idea is that employers, the state, and employees will each pay a third of the cost of childcare. The average cost for families dropped from $716 a month to $252 a month, and so that's a big difference. And we're seeing states like Kentucky and North Carolina and Indiana, they're all taking note of this TriShare model and pushing versions of their own. The problem is that it's still really modest. It still only covers a small fraction of the people who need it, and even the eligibility for that program is relatively limited. But you are seeing many more states just thinking in terms of this TriShare responsibility idea that everyone kind of has a role and a stake to play in financing this benefit, this access of care.
There is actually quite a bit of disagreement about whether employer-provided childcare is even actually a good idea. What are the downsides or the objections people might have?
Employers are not going to necessarily be prioritizing what's best for kids. They're going to always have their bottom line as their top priority. There's also, I would say, just a real concern that this could create more of a divide between people who have access to certain things and people who don't. And so there's fear that it moves further away from the idea of universal childcare.
Having reported on this, I mean, if you had to guess if 10 years from now we're going to see more employers providing childcare, what would you guess?
There's definitely a shift now, especially as we are seeing more companies end their remote work flexibility. So a lot more workers are returning to the office, which is putting the question of childcare front and center.
Rachel Cohen is a policy correspondent at Vox. Her reporting on employer-provided childcare is at Vox and well worth a read. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. APM, American Public Media.